All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. And I figure since it's the 8th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, now would be a good time, and especially when they're playing out the exact same, you know, Waco-style script about Gaddafi that they did about Saddam Hussein. He's crazy, like Koresh. He's crazy, he's bad to his own people, and he's got illegal weapons, and so we can't deal with him. We got to invade him with the Army Delta Force. Same story, different war, whether Waco, Iraq, or Libya. And but anyway, since it's the Iraq war invasion, I thought we could go back to a little bit of, you know, how they basically lied us into that war, propagandized us into that war, talk with Karen Kotowski, who had a front row seat from her position as an Air Force lieutenant colonel working inside the Pentagon. She wrote back then anonymously for David Hackworth's site, Soldiers for the Truth, and she has a humongous archive, which I believe includes the reprints of all those Hackworth site articles now at LouRockwell.com. And I also want to recommend to you a few great articles. There's a three-part series in the American Conservative magazine that she wrote, along with another one in Salon.com called The New Pentagon Papers. There's a great piece by Robert Dreyfus and Jason Vest called The Lie Factory. And there's also a great one in the LA Weekly called Soldier for the Truth, all about Karen Kotowski. There's quite a few other articles about her and her first-person account from inside the Pentagon. The very best interview that anyone has ever done or will ever do of Karen Kotowski about what she saw there was Brian Lamb on C-SPAN Q&A. And so if you just hit C-SPAN Q&A and figured out how to spell Kotowski and Googled that, you could certainly read that transcript or watch that interview, and it'll blow your mind. But that all being said, welcome back to the show, Karen. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for that great introduction there.
Well, you've got it coming. So, let me ask you this. When you were working at the Pentagon, did you ever hear that America was going to have a war with Iraq before September 11th, like, say, after Bush took office, but before the 9/11 attack? Was it already being talked about at the Pentagon, to your ears?
In my ears, no, but I was working in the North Africa shop at that time. And so, you know, we weren't focusing on the Middle East or anything. In the fall, after 9/11, you know, we're hearing more about Iraq. And then in the spring, when I moved into the Near East South Asia office, that's when I found out that the whole war plan had already been developed. And this is the spring of 2002. And you don't get them up to the Pentagon on the second review unless you've put the, you know, put the order out to go ahead and start fleshing out this plan. And, of course, the Pentagon says, well, we have plans for thousands of things. And I'm sure anyone who's listened to the news will, you know, oh, the Pentagon says, yeah, we have plans for invading all kinds of countries. That's true. But the order to update and expand and make it a practical, realistic, workable plan, that order apparently had happened sometime in the fall of 2001. By the time in the spring, early May of 2002, when I got to Near East South Asia Policy Office there at OSD, Office of Secretary of Defense, at that time, it was on its second review. Okay, this is what you would consider to be a pretty tight and mature plan to invade Iraq, to topple Saddam Hussein. And at that time, in the spring of 2002, most people, you know, the average people reading newspapers, watching TV, weren't hearing about Iraq. The propaganda war had to come after they already made their mind up. So it's pretty, I thought, in my experience, it was the first time I'd ever imagined this thing. But as I looked at history and became aware of our own history in this country, we've done this before, okay? We've planned a war, got ready to do it, and then sold it basically after the fact. Mm-hmm. We've done that before in our history, and we definitely did it in 2002, 2003 for the Iraq thing. Of course, I think historians will say this one blew up in our face because we were made to be liars relatively quickly after that invasion.
Right. Now, your boss, Bill Luddy, you yourself did not work for Douglas Feith and Abram Shulsky in the Office of Special Plans, but your boss, Bill Luddy, did,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, Bill Luddy did, and Bill Luddy's boss was Doug Feith.
Abram Shulsky worked for Luddy then?
Sorry? Yes, he did, yeah. Uh-huh. And he had, he worked for Luddy on paper. In actual fact, he was directly reporting to Doug Feith. Uh-huh. And he was the Office of Special Plans. Now, that office was formed in the summer of 2002, when late summer was set. It had its own spaces, but it was formed in the summer of 2002, and it was initially told to us as the expanded Iraq desk, but they put the Iran desk up there as well, so expanded Iran desk, because, you know, a lot of folks, if you think back to those many years ago, Iran was the target, probably still is. And so the idea was, you know, we'll go into Iraq, and we're already in Afghanistan, you know, pincher movement. We can change to the, you know, we can regime change Iran as well. So they're thinking that way, they being the neocons, because the neocons are obsessed with obsessed with the Middle East and these strange ideas of regime, you know, democracy imposed from above, and regime change will solve all your problems, and tearing up the Middle East, weakening the states around Israel. I mean, this is the obsession of the neocons, and this is what they were doing.
Well, now, Colin Powell, certainly just covering his rear end or trying to, said that Douglas Feith, what he did was he referred to the Office of Special Plans as the Gestapo office, so Feith's Gestapo office, and he told Bob Woodward that they basically created a parallel government to the U.S. government to get us into that war. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think that's a fair assessment, because these guys were putting out basic classified information, just like they're accusing Brad Manning of doing, but they put out classified information directly into the media, directly to Judy Miller, directly into the editors of these, you know, the Post and the New York Times, friendly newspapers, also the various websites that support the neocons. These guys are spouting off information that's not true, that they got directly from OSP, and OSP put it out there because it supported the storyline. It would build fear. It would build distrust. It would help make the president look like he was really, you know, knew what he was saying. And they did this consciously. They did it, like, you know, directly with the end goal in mind. And that end goal, of course, was to get the invasion. The Office of Special Plans disbanded within months after the invasion in March of 2003. They disbanded. Their whole purpose was to sell the war.
Mm-hmm. And mostly along weapons of mass destruction lines, right?
You know, I mean, yeah.
Well, I mean, they had this other thing called the Counterterrorism Policy Evaluation Group that was just two or three of these guys, and that was all focused on supposed ties between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, right?
Right, and they had their own guys. One guy that worked with me was tasked. He was an Egyptian. I mentioned him in the various articles that you mentioned in the American Conservative. But this he was a Navy lieutenant, a medical intel officer, but he spoke read Arabic. I think he spoke Arabic, too. He was an Egyptian-American officer. And he was tasked to go through the open media that they could find, kind of what some of the think tanks, the pro-Israel think tanks do. I think Memory does this as well, looks at the public media, what people are saying and writing in the Middle East. And he would go through that with the idea of gleaning points that they could later use to say, oh, Saddam said this, Saddam is doing that. And, of course, this is not intelligence. I mean, it's not. It's just information that fits your storyline. I mean, it's almost like dealing with a teenager who's trying to lie their way out of something. I mean, this is, you know, you take whatever you can get and you just weave a tale. And that's what they were doing, consciously doing it to sell the war. Because, of course, the plan had already been made to do it. You know, the war plan was ready to go. There was no, I don't think there was anything that was going to stop it. George Bush, of course, wanted it. The president is the president at the time was part and parcel to this. But the actual mechanics of creating and selling the war and pushing out information to kind of get people to be basically fearful, because we were not well informed. None of the information that OSP pushed out to the New York Times or to any of their various people, none of the stuff in the speeches that Condoleezza Rice made about, you know, bombs going off in St. Louis and things like that from Saddam Hussein, you know, none of this was fact-based. We were not well informed, but we were certainly stoked for fear. I mean, this is what they were trying to do.
You told me one time, I forget, and you've written about this as well, I think, was it Shulsky or Ludi who talked about how they were working directly with Scooter Libby in the vice president's office?
They were. Yeah, they talked about it, and it was evident in a number of different ways that both Ludi, who was actually appointed into his job from the vice president's staff. Ludi was when Bush got elected, Bush and Cheney got elected, or whatever, when it was finally decided. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Whatever
that
you
point,
call it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, even during that time when it hadn't been decided, Cheney had his staff, and Ludi was on that staff from day one. He had worked with him before. And so Ludi was ensconced with the VP's office, and when they finally got everything straightened out and they were in place, they were putting in their appointees, Ludi goes over into Near East South Asia Directorate as the deputy assistant secretary for Near East South Asia. This puts him over North Africa, Middle East, the whole area that we're talking about here. So he was Cheney's guy. In staff meetings, this guy Scooter Libby was mentioned a number of times. And initially, when I first heard his name, didn't know who he was, because you know we knew who the generals were, we knew who the people in the Pentagon were, and that's who we would be working with. If we went out of the Pentagon to provide formal documentation to it, we would go up the chain and over, not directly. But they were faxing stuff back and forth to Scooter Libby, who turned out to be, of course, chief of staff of Cheney's office and one of the key neocons and one of the key figures in this whole sales job that they did, this propaganda job that was conducted. And, of course,
he's the one that went to CIA headquarters 14 times saying, "Give me some dirt on Iraq."
That's right. And see, we in the Pentagon, we're dealing with our own problems. The DIA guys being told to shut up and say what we want to hear. But we're not thinking CIA is the problem. We didn't realize, this network of neocons that really had hijacked our foreign policy for sure. We didn't see that part that we read about later. Oh, Cheney and his staff are bugging the CIA analysts. They're terrorizing them.
Well, of course, you had John Bolton and David Wormser over at the State Department, too.
Well, now we knew a little bit about them, yeah.
Yeah, there was a great article in Salon called the State Department's Extreme Makeover about how, wow, I've never seen so many old CFR types lose their job and get fired and demoted and the State Department turned upside down is what's been going on here over the past couple of months.
They basically, and if you think about the neocons and the Wolfowitzes and all these guys, Richard Pearl, these folks that were key to having this country go to war and occupy the nation, which we are still occupying. I mean, we're still there. We're still killing Iraqis. This hasn't stopped. But the way they worked this, they did it in a smart way. They understood how government worked. They understood that when you tell somebody something they don't really want to hear, they might pick up the phone and call somebody else that they trust in another agency. They had people in every agency.
Right.
This is like it's really slick how this whole thing worked. And of course, to me, the bigger lesson learned is that why is our government so big that we can get these political appointed people? I mean, why? Where are these people coming from? Why don't they get a real job?
Yeah, no neocon has ever even been elected anything, if you call
that's
that a real
right.
job.
And they couldn't. They couldn't. And Newt Gingrich is getting ready to find this out, because he can't get elected. And he's one of the guys that's part of this problem and was very much of, loves war and, war for Israel, war for whatever purpose. He loves it. And he can't get elected. He's not popular. The neocons cannot get elected, and I guess that's one thing you could say that's a positive for democracy. I mean, the people may be sheep, but they're not incredibly, totally, always stupid. They actually can recognize people that are kind of scum to begin with, and unfortunately, the neocons, they don't go that route. If they went that route, we wouldn't have a problem with them, but what they do is they pose themselves as experts. They have a network. Who do you recommend? I recommend my friend, And it just so happens that any network could do this, but the neocons have done it to us in the past 20 years, actually longer, because a lot of these guys are recycled from when they were in the Reagan administration. Mm-hmm. So it's a shame. And all these people who love Reagan, they should look closely. And I actually respect Reagan a little bit because he pushed away from these folks in the second term, and they were very angry with him, and I thought that was great. But these guys have been in government for a long time. They know the game. They know how we react to things. I'd like to think maybe the American people are a little smarter because we've been lied to so many times, and we've seen how it comes out. But then again, look how quickly they were able to go into Libya.
Well, and look at Max Boot and Paul Wolfowitz leading the charge at the Wall Street Journal editorial page,
I don't know how these people get published. I just don't understand.
Yeah, on TV, they're like, well, Eric Edelman's an expert. We'll bring him on to tell us what to do.
Oh, my God. Yep. I don't know. I don't know if the media is just incompetent or if the media is actually colluding with neocons, because war is a fun thing to report. But bottom line is, it kills people, it destroys property, it destroys wealth.
Well, you can always charge more for dish soap ads, when there's a war on.
That's right. That's right. It's just a terrible thing. And really, I think what the Libya thing, I didn't really write about this today in what I wrote, but it seems like what's happened in Libya, at least as far as the UN and our actions in bombing and bombing from afar, you know, the safe war that we like to do, that apparently is sanitary and never kills anybody. I don't know where they get this idea. But, you know, we still have a huge problem. Where was the debate on should we invade or should we bomb or
Well, the debate was there for 3 weeks in a row. It was, why hasn't he invaded yet? And then, okay, we're trying to hurry, and then they finally gave in to the dissent, which was, you're taking too long.
Yeah, and then the two sides are, he took too long, and the other side says, no, he didn't.
Right.
to the two debating sides.
Yep. Yeah. And by the way, you know, the Iraq war resulted in the death of about 1 million people, 5 million refugees, police state with secret torture prisons that the Red Cross is not allowed to. People still don't have electricity or water or any old thing. You know, if you remember back to the propaganda in 02 about how great this was all going to be and how necessary it all was, it's really just amazing to compare and contrast that to the reality of that war.
That's right, and also it's not even a safe country for us to even occupy because of the radiation in the soil and other places where we bombed the living hell out of these places with depleted uranium shells. You know, that stuff is there. You can't get rid of it. You have to take all the dirt away. There's no way to do that. They can't, like you said, they don't have water and electricity and plumbing. So it's just an outrageous criminal act, even to this day. It was a crime to go to war against our domestic laws, which I'm talking about the Constitution. You know, there was no declaration of war. There was lying. I mean, impeachable offenses done by, guys like Ludi, Cheney. Any of these guys should have been, you know, removed from their offices for the crimes they did. And then the crimes have just multiplied. Now you have, you know, the folks in Iraq, what's left of them, struggling to live. And it's no wonder they probably wish for the days when Saddam Hussein was there, where they had schools and education, and they had a relatively clean environment. It didn't have contamination.
Yeah. Well, you know what I wonder? I wonder, Gareth Porter and others have reported that, well, and I think it was pretty obvious, right? I think you even said they always did want Iran to be part of this. But why didn't they push for Iran first instead of Iraq? Why was Iraq the target? Was it just a Halliburton thing or what? Because it seemed like if you wanted to make a plausible case for expanding the terror war to one of Israel's enemies, you say, well, look, Iran backs Hamas and Hezbollah, right? That's their terrorist's case right there. They could have gotten away with attacking Iran instead of Iraq. Was it because Iraq was doable and Iran wasn't? Or what do you think?
First off,
the Israelis certainly wanted Iran. That's what I was trying to get to.
We only pick on the very weak. Okay, we don't go after anybody that can fight back, first off. And that's a major thing. Somebody should explain to Petraeus or ask him and have him explain why we only pick on fourth-rate military powers. But we do. So Iraq fit the bill that way, had no military, had no navy, had no air force. We've been bombing them for, 10, 11 years in the no-fly zone? He had nothing. So he was seen as an easy target. Same with Afghanistan. They didn't have any particular, that thing went over, in a couple of weeks or whatever. It was nothing. So, and the idea is these wars will be popular. They'll keep America safe because America hates Islamic terrorism, and we've pegged it this way. So, and then the idea is we can harass and do Iran over time, like perhaps, maybe we can weaken them in some way over time. But, there's no way they could take on Iran. Our military, first off, we can't take on Afghanistan with our military. We got lots of boots on the ground, some of the best soldiers we have, and they're making zero progress. Okay, so this idea that Iran is doable, Iran is not doable in any military or strategic sense. It's not going to happen. I think they would have had a tough time explaining that. They would have had a tough time doing it because, these guys want, it's all about the show. It's all about mission accomplished banners. Hey, look how good we're doing. Look at all the schools we painted. Look at all the women we liberated. Like, that's a big joke. But, that's what they're, it has to be able to be sold. You couldn't have done that with Iran. Iran would have done that to us, and they would have had the stories of victory that they would have told to their people,
Do they have the troops to, say, put, 30 or 50,000 soldiers in Libya? Or no way? Tell me no way.
What, us?
Yeah.
I don't know where we would get those troops from.
All right, well, that's what I want to hear. All right,
now,
I'm sorry. We're all out of time, Karen. We got to move on. But I really appreciate everything that you've written all this time and all your appearances on the show. I really appreciate it.
And I appreciate what you're doing, Scott. Great way to get the word out and make people think about things.
Well, thanks very much. All right, everybody, that's Karen Kotowski. And you can find her archive at lourockwell.com. Her piece there today is Thoughts on the Insanity. And just Google her name, and especially the Q&A with Brian Lamb. That's some excellent stuff there. We'll be back after this.